This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.
Hi, everybody. Welcome once again to Recovery Radio. My name is Steve Martorano. We're here on Saturdays at this time. We talk about the disease of addiction and the probably lesser known fact that in spite of how grim the news is, and it's grim, lots and lots of people, millions in fact, have found their way to successful long-term sobriety. So we want to remind people each and every week as we discuss the disease of addiction that that is possible. Recovery Radio is sponsored by Retreat, premier addiction treatment centers. And as we do so very often, we rely upon Retreat for expert insights into the treatment of the disease of addiction. To that end, we welcome our guest today from Florida. He works at Retreat's West Palm facility, Garrett Cooper. Garrett's 37 years old, and he is a primary therapist at Retreat. He is on the front lines, as you can imagine, fighting this absolutely almost overwhelming opiate epidemic we are seeing that is ravaging not only the country, but in particular populations of young people. And Garrett focuses in his treatment and his therapy on young adults between the ages of 22 and 26. So we welcome Garrett Cooper to Recovery Radio. Garrett, thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
So how did you get involved in this field? Give me some of your background.
I'm a master level therapist, and when I was pursuing my master's, initially I was looking to help out veterans, as being a veteran myself. With the VA had a hiring freeze. I'm in South Florida, so I looked into what opportunities, and I was with the facility that had dual diagnosis, and I actually really started like working with people that were in recovery, you know, helping them through their struggles, and seemed to be able to connect with a lot of people in that sense. And since my three-year journey, I was working primarily as outpatient, and then I found my way here at Retreat in the residential program, and I find it really fulfilling, really a lot of enjoyment and helping, especially with the younger population for the 22, 26-year-olds.
Mm-hmm. So you started on one path, I mean, one area of of concern, and then you sort of pivoted and found yourself dealing with something else. With regard to your initial, and that's what this is, initial exposure to what opiates are doing, particularly to that young age group, what struck you immediately about it?
Just the fact of, like, the epidemic that's going on with the opioids and opiates and how it's impacting, and, you know, especially with the society today and the amount of deaths. And it kind of struck me as, like, as a therapist, like, where could I be putting my best interest in doing the most work, and how can I be helping out? And I just felt like, especially with the anxiety, with the PTSD and how intense it was, like, I wanted something that would challenge me, and two, like, I feel like I could provide the best service to help out. Especially the youth.
Yeah, it's sort of like being parachuted into a raging forest fire. And, you know, no matter where you wind up working, you're going to be doing some good, because this thing is devastating. And it's not unfair or a mischaracterization to say, with regard to the opioids, this is out of control. This is officially out of control now. Correct?
No, definitely. Especially with drugs on the market like fentanyl and carfentanil, you know, the amount of deaths is it's hiking up. But then I'm not sure, quote, but I think it was 60,000 deaths, but 40,000 were due to opiates last year, and primarily the opioids, which is, you know, prescribed medications.
Mm-hmm. We know that the death toll is outrageous. I mean, if this were a communicable disease, we would be in full-blown crisis mode. And I think you'd see a lot more urgency than we're seeing now. But it is changing. With regard to the client base that you deal with, young adults, give me a profile of who they are. Are these kids of lesser circumstance? Are these kids who drop out of school, broken homes, violent? Who are they?
Primarily, like, my age group I work with, like we mentioned before, they're 22, 26. They come from various backgrounds. They're not all from broken homes. They're not all from traumatic backgrounds. It could be kids that got caught up in, like, the social scene, wanted to experiment in drugs, and they got hooked on opiates just through exploring and through an experimental stage. Most of my patients started using drugs at a young age, from 12 now to 14, which we're seeing younger and younger each year that's going by, that, you know, young, the youth is exploring or experimenting more with drugs. And it, most of my patients I work with, they are primary opiate addicts or opioid addicts, and they're behavioral too, which means that they're usually repeat offenders at treatment centers.
So you're seeing the hardcore cases.
Correct.
What about their introduction to opiates? What has struck me most, beyond all the obvious death and destruction of this stuff, is that I come out of that 60s generation. I understand about youthful experimentation with drugs, but it was an article of faith when I grew up, was that there was some sort of progression for people that were going to wind up in trouble. They began someplace at a lesser level, and then the unfortunate few worked themselves up to full-blown IV drug use and devastation. Something's changed here. They're getting involved in this kind of heavy drug use much earlier, correct?
No, correct. Unfortunately, with gateway drugs and every biopsychosocial, I've noticed there is a correlation that youth are nowadays starting off with marijuana even before alcohol. And like you said, marijuana, alcohol, especially when you look at marijuana, THC levels were much lower, and now it's much higher, where it's almost a controlled substance. So you have adolescent minds that are developing that are on strong controlled substances with THCs that are above 20%. And, you know, like, this is a developing mind, and it's impacting them, and especially with their amygdala and how it's, you know, hurting their you know, pleasure factory and all these other things, and how it just contributes. And then they slowly progress from there to other heavier, harder drugs, yeah, the pills. And then the pills become too expensive, and then now you have your opiates and heroin.
And that process is accelerated beyond anybody's imagination. It doesn't take, obviously, it doesn't take years for 20-year-olds to work their way to heroin. It takes, what, months?
Correct.
Let's stop for a second and go back to this marijuana thing, because, you know, we keep, and again, if you come out of the 60s and you hear these people say, boy, this marijuana today is way different than it was then, this is sort of like, oh, yeah, really? But it is. There's no doubt now. We do know it's stronger. Are you suggesting that without regard to whether marijuana leads to this kind of abuse of opioids, that if you start out with a higher dose of any intoxicant, your likelihood of getting to something really dangerous is greater?
Yes, definitely. I mean, especially if it's not controlled, and if it's not somehow regulated, because with the developing minds and being so easily accessible, it's easy for teens now to get marijuana, and it would be alcohol. And so if they're in the experimental stage, and especially culturally, with the social aspect of when they're younger, is that it's okay. It's, you know, you're young, and there's a time to experiment. But it's not the same, like you said, from the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And what impact does it really have on a developing mind with THC? And especially if you look at MRIs, and like THC, and you know, it does leave holes, patches in the brain where blood flow isn't, you know, flowing normal or naturally.
Well, and you know, marijuana has been so stigmatized for so many years and decades now as the evil weed that could cause everything from insanity to who knows what. Mm-hmm. And that was a gross exaggeration of the effects of the drug. And now I think the pendulum has swung way far in the other direction.
Correct. Well, paranoid disorder has been proven to be a long-term side effect of THC.
And well, now, of course, it's mm-hmm. being characterized not only as a magic medicinal remedy for everything, but also almost like a sacrament. They're infusing it in food. They're ingesting it every way they can. States, governments look at it as a revenue source. I think the law of unintended consequences is going to start biting a lot of people in the butt on this thing. But with regard to what you do and the work at a place like Retreat, you're not seeing people who are just smoking too much marijuana. You're seeing people with full blown heroin addictions, correct?
Yeah, IV opiate addictions primarily my caseload that I work with. So it progresses, like I was mentioning before, it starts off with marijuana, and then it usually progresses for people. They had the pill mills, especially down here in Florida, and so people were buying Oxys. They were buying Roxys, so the opioids. And when they shut and close that off, people were still had an addiction, so they're going through an opiate withdrawal, so they turned to heroin.
Garrett, how many of your clients, do you have a figure or a percentage off the top of your head, how many of them developed a full-blown opioid addiction who began on pharmaceutical drugs rather than street drugs? Do you have any idea of what that number is?
It would be over 90%.
Over 90%. So people keep wanting to know where this came from. It came from drugstores, right? And doctor's
Correct.
Offices.
Pharmaceutical companies. And so when you look at it, it was like, well, it came from a pharmaceutical company. It can't be that bad. You know, it's just a pill. You know, I'm not that bad yet. But then when the pills ran out or they become too expensive and, you know, patients going through an opiate withdrawal, he's going to try to, you know, alleviate the symptoms and pain that he's going through, he or she. So that's when, you know, heroin becomes more acceptable for them and how it becomes easier to transition and progress through this, especially when they've already developed the disease, when they're already doing the heavier narcotics.
Yeah, the other insidious nature and tragedy of the opioid problem is that, yes, if you're introduced to this stuff in a pill form, there is something benign about pills. You don't have to go into dark alleys to buy them. They're in the medicine cabinet. The doctor prescribed them for everything from impacted wisdom teeth to, you know, back pain. So it was the perfect storm. Garrett Cooper is our guest on Recovery Radio today. Garrett is a primary therapist working with Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers in Florida. He is dealing with the opiate crisis. His patient base is made up of young adults who are being just absolutely destroyed by this drug. We have more with Garrett straight ahead. Please don't go away. And welcome back to Recovery Radio. Garrett Cooper, primary therapist with Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers in Florida, is our guest on Recovery Radio this week. He deals with young adults, 22, 26 years old, who have serious opioid addiction problems. Garrett is a veteran of the United States Navy. He's had a career in finance. He's a single father with three children. Decided that he needed to do something with regard to helping what began as an effort for veterans with post-traumatic disorders, and finds himself now treating this population, which needs all the help it can get. So, Garrett, talk about young people with serious heroin problems. What are some of the things people have to look out for? I mean, if the doctor's prescribing this stuff and you don't know whether you're going to wind up addicted to it until it's perhaps too late, what should people be looking out for?
And it's a tough question because for each, you know, person, sensitivity to drugs, you know, varies. But one of the things I would definitely tell parents to look for is, especially if children are minimizing their drug use. A lot of patients would not, even to this day, parents may not even know the full extent of how much drugs they're using or what type of drugs or how their drugs are administrated. They may say, well, I've used, you know, opiates a little bit, but don't worry, Mom, it's just pills. But they're really doing IV heroin in the case. And so, like, with trying to open up that communication line, you know, especially with the family, like, talk about drugs, the impact it has, especially on the developing mind, you know, to be encouraged, you know, children to, like, talk to their parents and say, look, Mom, you know, I knew so-and-so, you know, they were getting pills. Like, what do these do to you? Like, what will happen if I were to use these pills? What effects do they really have? So try to open that line of communication to begin with. And, you know, especially even at a younger age, educate children on, like, you know, you hear a lot of things about how marijuana is, but let's look at the long-term effects. What are consequences if you, at your age, with your mind, start using it? And so just to create that, you know, open communication along the way. But the first thing I look for is, look at behavioral issues. You know, is your child stealing from you? Are they lying about where they're doing and going? These are, unfortunately, some warning signs. And well, if you know they're using drugs, yeah, how are they minimizing their drug use?
Yeah, some of the warning signs that I've read about in this stuff you're talking about now are, after the fact, certainly obvious. If someone's stealing from you, particularly if he comes from a sort of middle-class background. In other words, he doesn't need to steal to eat. He's just stealing. That would be a huge red flag. But what about situations where you have a young adult in your life and they lack ambition and they don't seem to be able to hold on to jobs and it doesn't look like drug use, but they always need you to write a check because they couldn't make a car payment. Are those things that are those situations worth exploring a little deeper?
Definitely. If what happened when we have, you had money lined up, you have a good job or you're in college, you know, we gave you money for this, what's going on? And correct. It's, you know, where we failed to meet our obligations. There's, you know, not committed to our responsibilities. And those are definitely some warning signs. Like what's going on? What's happening? Where are you at? Through the drug use too, especially with opioids, like maybe what are they escaping? And so, like, if you notice depression and they seem to be real manic afterwards, and then, that, you know, like, what's going on? This doesn't make sense. You're down, and now you're feeling really good and too good, too quick.
Is it safe to say parents cannot be, or people in the lives of young people, cannot be too vigilant on this situation? Because, you know, look, there's behavior. There's slacker behavior that's been around forever. That doesn't necessarily mean someone's abusing drugs. So what are people who worry about their loved ones to do? Should they back off or be more proactive about this if they're worried?
The proactive aspect of behavior, especially the communication, should be taking place more at adolescent level. But if your child does become an addict, you know, the enabling behavior becomes difficult. And when I talk with parents, it's hard for them to stop enabling their child, stop paying for things when they're not trying to better themselves. Because all you're doing is prolonging their addiction.
How many of the people, Garrett, that you treat in the mid-20s are still living home?
Well, I would say about half. Some parents do have healthier boundaries where they tell the child, listen, this is not acceptable. And that this isn't, our family doesn't approve of this behavior, so they'll say, no, you have to figure it out. And then the other half are still, you know, parents are still paying their phone bills for them, still making in car payments, are still allowed to freely come and go in the house.
Is that a dangerous thing for people to do, even if there's no overt evidence of drug abuse? Do you know what I mean?
Yes, no, I do. And it is. It's actually extremely dangerous for parents to do that because you're creating what's called a safety net for the patient. And when you do that, it gives them the opportunity to buy more drugs.
Or even if they're not buying drugs, if they realize someone will catch them if they fall, they may be inclined to take greater risks.
Correct.
Is that right?
No, definitely. If you have the means of opportunity, I mean, like you said, if the child doesn't see the risk of the behavior, doesn't have the insight, then what would the outcome be?
It's very difficult for parents to do the things necessary when the situation reaches a critical portion and they know that drugs are being abused. Everything they are then required to do is antithetical to what their instincts tell them a parent should do, correct?
Right. That's one thing that Retreat does offer is a family education program, and that is to educate families on how not to enable and create healthy boundaries to support your child when they're doing the right thing versus the wrong thing. To it, and it helps encourage and brings back patients that suffer from this, you know, disease.
Mm-hmm. How much more difficult is it for a young adult to overcome an addiction if the family is not, you know, full in on it?
It's a family disease. We could be regressing in therapy, but if a patient's struggling because they're having a severe craving, and this times that we do rely on families to help, you know, be supportive of a patient staying in treatment, and if the parent is not on board, it's that the patient is going to leave. And unfortunately, that they don't commit through what their plan is. Oh, don't worry, I'm fine. It's they're getting high within the hour.
Young adults and addiction, that's the topic of Recovery Radio this week with our guest Garrett Cooper. We have more with Garrett straight ahead. Please don't go away. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. Steve Martorano with you. We're here on Saturdays. We talk about the disease of addiction and we talk about the road to recovery. Retreat, Premier Addiction Treatment Centers, of course, the sponsors of the program, and I give you the phone number and tell you every week, I hope you never have to use it. That comes from the top of this organization to the bottom. Yes, they pay the freight here. Yes, they are a nationally renowned treatment facilities here and in South Florida. They've helped lots and lots of people. But we give you the phone number for informational purposes. You can call Retreat. They will answer your questions. If they can help you, they certainly stand ready to do that. If they can just answer your questions, they'll do that as well. So again, here's the number, 855-859-8808. Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers, 855-859-8808. From their West Palm Beach facility, primary therapist Garrett Cooper has been our guest today. Garrett, you could not be or have a more front row seat on the problems of the opioid epidemic that is sweeping through this country, showing absolutely no favoritism as to who can be affected by this across the socioeconomic and cultural landscape. All kinds of people and families have been devastated by this opiate epidemic. But there is a particularly cruel aspect to young people who are swept up in this thing. 22 to 26-year-olds, that is the primary age group that our guest deals with. And as I said, he's in the foxhole dealing with them. Hey, Garrett, let me ask you a question. You are not in the program. You are not in recovery. You have not had a substance abuse problem in your life, right?
That's correct.
Do you find that some people wonder about that? I mean, after all, if you've not been there, how could you possibly talk about this?
That is actually a question that's brought up quite a bit throughout my career from patients and parents. I know, how do you understand addiction if you haven't had suffered from the same disease as other people? And as a mental health therapist, you know, most of my sessions that I work with patients is not educating them on their drug use or how drugs impact them, but more mental health. There is often a co-current problem that goes along with their addiction, whether it be anxiety, depression, or some type of personality disorder that influences, and that they use the drug as an escape to overcome what's really going on for them. Patients that I work with predominantly are usually behavioral, so I think they display like antisocial personality disorders, and through that, so they're acting out, they're acting defiant, they're trying to be manipulative in their treatment program. They've been institutionalized through multiple treatment failures prior. So with that, it's just getting them to start challenging their behaviors. So I use primarily like a cognitive behavioral-based approach where we're looking at like, how can we reframe your thoughts on this? What is a counter thought that you have that in the situation that occurred? I also look at is that my patients are very impulsive quite often in this emotional base. So with that, I use ACT. So through it's called self as a context, I'm trying to create awareness of like, or self as a process. Where's your emotions at right now? Like, look at, you know, are they accurate? What is it that how you respond to your emotions in this situation, and how we can, you know, shift and make change, make better decisions and outcomes that align with your value system.
Let's start at the beginning with the process that someone like you, oversees. Someone mm-hmm. shows up at a treatment facility with a serious heroin addiction or opioid addiction. They need immediate medical treatment, correct? Take me through the process. They need to be detoxed.
Correct. So they'll go through a detox protocol, and through that they'll be giving like a Suboxone or Subutex to help bring their withdrawal symptoms down. And then that, you know, depending on their drug use, can last up to usually a week. Now, we're residential, so this is more of a stabilization. So patients are definitely going through post-acute withdrawal symptoms. Behavioral emotions are coming back that they weren't feeling before. Thoughts that they've been having or avoiding or trying to escape are now there in the forefront. So we're doing a lot of crisis management intervention, especially with the younger population that have been using, you know, heroin or fentanyl as, you know, their drug of choice. And just, you know, trying to keep a focus, understand that, you know, their anxiety that they're feeling right now is not forever. Through ACT, it's, you know, accepting that it's okay, you have a human condition.
I'm going to stop you. Explain ACT again in a little more detail. What is that?
It's a mindfulness approach. It was based off of RFT and CBT, so it's like a second wave off of postmodern. But what it really does is it tries to create awareness and acceptance. A lot of patients I work with, as I mentioned, or have multiple treatment failures. This traditional CBT approach may not have been effective. It doesn't speak to them. So with ACT, it's looking at it as like accepting more of where you're at and learning to work through it versus avoiding or just reframing it through a positive way of thinking.
Well, talk about I understand that when you withdraw from this drug under medical supervision, suddenly you are no longer self-medicating. All of the things that in your life that may have contributed to putting you in this addictive position are now laid bare and have to be dealt with, and that
Correct.
Folks like you are trained to go to those issues in an effort to stop a relapse.
Correct.
What work is done on the craving? It's one thing to suddenly be aware that you've been traumatized or you've had problems in your life or you're acting up and all of that behavioral stuff, but it's the physical craving that drives people back, isn't it?
Correct. And to seek and find, with the disease lies in the midbrain, so it's constantly pushing to seek and find. You know, how can therapy help someone with that? And it's getting them comfortable talking and telling on themselves, like, I feel this way. And when patients start opening up and start talking and say, look, I'm really struggling staying sober, and we normalize it for them, is like, that's not abnormal, someone to be in early recovery, to suffer what you're going through. Tell me more about what's going on. You know, what else is happening for you? What else would happen if we continue to use and process? And then explain to them, like, have you had cravings before? What have you noticed about them? You know, there's a beginning and an end. This seems like forever, but will it be forever? How long could we, you know, supporting you, could you hold out?
Yeah. Are you able in this kind of cognitive behavioral therapy to train people to notice the triggering events that might lead to a craving?
Definitely through CBT and ACT. As CBT, I use it more for the intervention of like reframing, but the ACT, I use it especially self as a process of acknowledging the emotions. Anger, as we say, could be emotion that's due to feeling threatened, but are you really threatened in this situation? How is it that you feel threatened? You know, what would your anger be telling you, or what is it, the underlying emotion that could be behind the anger?
Garrett, do I understand cognitive behavior therapy? I know this is a gross simplification, but it seeks to change the way people think, so then they will change the way they behave.
Correct. Mind, thought, feelings.
That's it. It's just that is what the essence of cognitive behavior is.
Correct.
So when someone comes in and they're not stupid, they can see their behavior, they can maybe even appreciate the process you just talked about, that, oh, yeah, my anger is making me do this, or my fear is making me do this, and yet they continue to go back on drugs. How does that cycle broken?
A lot of times I educate the patient on, look at the stimulus-seeking behavior that you're displaying. Look at early warning signs. A lot of patients that I work with, they're putting, you know, half a cup of coffee with sugar, you know, they're smoking cigarettes repeatedly throughout the day. And again, it's their homeostasis level in their midbrain is off. So they try to educate them, understand that, you know, all these behaviors that you're displaying or wanting is because you're trying to feel normal again, more of a natural state. And if we can, you know, try to create an environment for you that could be stimulating and help you feel a little more normal in a positive manner, what could we be doing different, especially in your life?
Mm-hmm.
What would fun and sobriety look like? Sobriety is not just abstinence. Sobriety is about living life and being active.
Garrett, how many of the young people you see feel that they are, they're just powerless against these urges? They just can't control them.
I get that question a lot, especially from parents. They'll just, you know, when they figure it out, they'll figure out they choose this. And unfortunately, the way disease looks, willpower is not enough. That's why I would encourage, you know, especially parents and patients, that when you leave here at retreat, seek PHP, seek IOP. These structured supportive environments are key to your recovery, because you yourself will not have enough willpower against these strong urges and cravings. But someone that has, you know, sobriety, or a therapist that has, you know, knowledge, you know, we can help guide you through it and keep you sober so that you give your brain a chance to heal. I know studies that show that 18 months to 3 years is how long it takes for the brain to heal back to where it's functioning at more of a normal level.
Mm-hmm. Garrett Cooper, primary therapist at Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers in Florida, is our guest on the phone. He treats young adults. What percentage of, you said earlier that you have people who have relapsed many times. What percentage of your patient bases are relapses?
Unfortunately, with addiction, and it's the hardest thing, is I would say about 60% for long-term recovery have relapsed.
60%?
Correct.
Why do people keep coming back to treatment when they're multiply relapse?
Again, it's because people don't want to give up on themselves. Most of my patients, they aren't choosing that they want to continue to be an addict. They're fighting to stay clean, but it's difficult, you know, if they don't put themselves in a safe environment, they don't have support, and, you know, like some type of structure that helps them out. Because themselves, with their amygdala, it's just they don't have the willpower to overcome their midbrain, or as we call the lizard brain.
Yeah, yeah. We now know that there is heroin on the market now that is laced with some absolutely deadly stuff, fentanyl being the most obvious mm-hmm. one. Almost every time I read about a drug overdose, it is characterized as accidental.
Correct.
Is that, in your experience, mm-hmm. how many of these people are actually suicidal?
Very rare.
Is that right?
Yeah. Most of the patients I work with, they do not want to die. They're actually afraid of death. They're hoping that if they use one more time, that it'll just be okay, and they'll just use enough to get by. In addiction, it's not always patients seeking just to get high. They could be seeking for maintenance just so they can avoid their own withdrawals and just try to function in life. So, concept that it's just, you know, addict just wants to be totally knotted out and try to seek this euphoric is not always the case. They're just sometimes trying to just avoid the withdrawal.
Yeah. What is the attitude? You know, we have about we should pick up this on the backside, because the relapse part of this discussion is critical, I think, because a lot of people see this behavior in their lives and others' lives and read about it, and they think nothing works. They always relapse. And that's not true. Some people do get healthy.
If you take the retreat model, especially how many people actually complete our program, it's because they're in a safe, structured environment. It shows that through that approach, it is effective. But it's a volunteer program. And that's where it's difficult if you don't have family on board. If we don't eliminate access to means of buying drugs, it's very difficult from our side to encourage a patient to stay sober, especially when they're feeling a strong craving.
Yeah, Garrett Cooper, our guest here on Recovery Radio. We have yet another segment with Garrett, so stick around. This is Recovery Radio. Welcome back. Recovery Radio, again, here on Saturdays, talking about the disease of addiction and sponsored by Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. From their West Palm Beach facility, we have had with us this week primary therapist Garrett Cooper. Garrett deals with young adults who are in serious, serious opioid addictive problems. Garrett, let's take this final segment to talk about, maybe dispel one of the great myths that exists about any kind of addiction, and that is that, I call it the Sandra Bullock theory of treating it, and that's where Sandra goes to 28-day treatment, meets a cute guy, gets healthy, and they leave at the end of the movie together. I think a lot of people who get their loved ones or young adults or even individuals who arrive at that first treatment moment think that's what's going to happen. When we know that to successfully defeat or manage the disease of addiction, we're talking about a process and not one thing. Is that right?
No, definitely. Studies have shown patients that have over 90 days, the outcome of not relapsing dramatically improves. And that goes along with, like you said, the Sandra Bullock 28 days, this concept of believing that, you know, I can spend 28 days in a treatment center and I'll be fine when I walk out. But if you look at like a depression or anxiety, you're looking at 90 days of therapy with the outside private therapist. And we're now thinking that 28 days will be okay for addiction. It doesn't make sense when you break it down in that aspect. So what the process looks like is that you do a stabilization. And in stabilization, you're going through detox. So your first 2 weeks, your patient may not even be fully cognitive aware or fully oriented what's going on because of they're going through a detox protocol.
That stabilization period is not unlike somebody's being brought in who's been in a horrific accident or something, right?
Correct. No, they're just not even fully oriented. They're not, their judgment's clouded. The brain's literally trying to heal. And you look at it, it's like as a therapist, you have probably 3 weeks where you can start doing solid work and start planting seeds for what their next level of care. And that next level of care would be like a PHP, a partial hospitalization, which is very similar to a residential setting where again, they're going to be in a sober living environment. Through that, they're going to be meeting clinical. They're going to be 7 hours, 7 days a week, working on themselves too, along with that, trying to go to outside meetings, build their support system as well. That usually lasts about 30 days. And again, the 30 days is hopes that we're, again, healing the brain along the way, along with the behavioral changes of the patient. After that PHP, you go to intensive IOP. That there's different levels of IOP. It could be IOP 5, 3, or 1.
That's an outpatient procedure.
Correct.
Right.
So with that, they're, again, in a supportive living environment that's structured. It's helping them be accountable. Along with that, they're going to see their therapist 3 times a week with groups and an individual. And that's to reinforce the behavioral changes that they've been working on since. That could last up for some patients. It could be up to like 6 months. After that, then, you know, they're going to go to the three quarter. They'll go to like an outpatient setting where they meet their therapist once a week. They already have their support system and they're living independently.
How daunting is it to explain to someone, particularly someone young, that they have a disease that is incurable and that they are going to have to live with it and manage it, as you just described, for the rest of their lives? There must be an almost overwhelming urge to reject that.
And it's a big part of our work here in civilization is to overcome that, because we're fighting the patient's urge to want to go back and use. And the patient may not be ready to want to work or change or see themselves or even change who they are. And it's almost sometimes an hourly battle with patients of that they just don't want to commit to helping themselves.
It's very difficult to stigmatize. First of all, to be stigmatized and to accept that you have this chronic condition. That's got to be a major block to getting healthy. The refusal to accept that, right?
It does, you know, attribute to it. It's, what's the point? I'm an addict. People see me as an addict. Why even bother? I'll just be an addict.
Who needs to get that message, quicker? Does the addict have to get that question? Does the family have to get that question? Who has to deal with that most immediately?
I would definitely say, like, it does help when the family can validate the patient, understand and say, like, we're here to help you get help. We want you to do the next best thing, but we're also not here to support your addiction either.
Right. What's your view on the, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
What's your view on interventions? Do they work? Are they dangerous? Are they recommended?
I think interventions are great. It shows family support. It shows that they're encouraging a patient to better themselves, that they're, you know, it's opening up communication with an expert in the room that will make the patient feel protected too.
They should be handled with an expert in the room?
I believe it does help. It does, because the patient doesn't feel like it's just, you know, mom and dad feeling the way they do. But there's usually an education process before an intervention. So the intervention is just trying to teach the family to understand, like, what the patient's going through.
If someone were to call retreat, could they get information just on that? How do I get a good interventionist who does that?
Yes. I mean, we should have coordinators that will be able to help you when they call and that they can put you in touch with what they recommend interventions in your area.
Well, listen, Garrett, we appreciate not only your time, but your work. This problem is huge. It doesn't appear to be getting any smaller. Are you hopeful, though, that we've seen a sea change, at least in the attitude and seriousness of this disease?
Yes, we have. I am hopeful, because proven models and with that have actual empirical evidence, you can see the outcomes, and they are improving and they are increasing. And as people become more educated in how addiction works, we can handle it better versus trying to treat it as like this choice. They just choose this. It may have been a choice in the beginning when they start experimenting with drugs, but once their mind becomes diseased, it's no longer a choice. Willpower will never be enough. And people are coming around understanding, and science is supporting this. The medical community is, you know, being able to. So through this education and change and how we're even approaching it, we'll see dramatic increases. And especially when we recognize that time is the best thing for our patients. The more time they have being abstinent, the more it gives their brain a chance to heal, and they'll be able to pick up and improve just their own cognitability and start feeling normal sensation again that they have been feeling for a long time.
Garrett Cooper, thanks so much for joining us. I remind everybody, if you have questions or comments, 855-859-8808. That gets you Retreat. Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. Garrett, again, thanks for your time. The rest of you, enjoy the rest of your weekend, and please look for Recovery Radio here on Saturdays. Bye-bye.
This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.